time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Beverly Graham. Beverly Graham has been a creating and performing artist musician since the age of 15. She has recorded 8 full-length albums and has written and illustrated 6 children's books. And she is the founding executive director of the largest outdoor meal provider program for the homeless and food insecure in Washington State, Operation Sack Lunch, which has served more than 2 million meals since 1989. Beverly, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting us.
So start out, tell us about the origins of Operation Sack Lunch.
We started in 1989. I say we because... I started it, except as you move on, you realize that an organization isn't something that you do all by yourself. It becomes the ideas and thoughts and creative force of many people. And so in 1989, I had a moment of radical bad health, a life and death moment. And as I was recovering from that moment, I thought about all the folks that I would see on the street when I was working clubs downtown. They just came into my mind. What if this happened to them? Because I was being taken care of. My family took care of me. They fed me. They carried me to the bathtub. They bathed me. And I thought of people who live without houses. How do they eat? How do they bathe? Food became so important. Every 2 hours I had to eat. Everything I ate had to be organic, no meat, no pesticides, no herbicides, no food additives, no coloring, no preservatives. You know, how does somebody take care of themselves if this happens to them? And as I began to recover, one day I just packed up 30 lunches, drove downtown, and handed them out. It wasn't a lifelong ambition. I wasn't doing it because I wanted to save the world. I was doing it to make myself feel better about what I had not yet contributed to the world. I've always sung about social injustice or social justice and expected that was my community service. And I realized at some point that if I wasn't the one getting off my butt and doing it, why should anybody else? So this one day I packed up 30 lunches, drove downtown, 30 turned to 50, to 100, to 200, to 800, to, you know, right now we're serving 1,200 meals a day, about 34,000 meals a month, and we have actually served more than 3.5 million meals since 1989. So, we are doing about 450,000 meals a year. We do breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week. It used to be called Operation Sack Lunch because, you know, I walked around with bag lunches, organic bag lunches. But now we do hot meals, mainly hot meals and hot food for people. So what you would get in a restaurant, that quality food, a good restaurant, not McDonald's, I'm sorry, but a good restaurant, that's the type of food that we serve to our guests, to the people who are hunger challenged in our city.
So in those early days, you made all this food yourself?
I did, and I totally wasn't health department compliant. You know, I had no idea. I was just somebody who had a heart for trying to figure out how to hear the stories of the people who I, quite frankly, had a fear of. I know I had a fear of that kind of poverty, and I didn't know. I didn't understand it, and I wanted to become somebody who had an absolute empathy for people who have challenges, you know, living challenges. And so I packed up the food from my own refrigerator, and eventually, you know, it became too much. We were I was using my house payment to buy food and my kids' college education to buy food. And we mortgaged a house, took a second mortgage so I could continue to buy food. I mean, it became one of the fires that burned inside of me, because I started to learn that everybody has a face and everybody has a name and everyone has a story. And even somebody who is challenged with alcohol or drugs or addiction they need to eat. They need to know that they have worth, and they need to know they are loved, and they need to know that they have a right to excellent nutrition. We all do. Just because we're born naked and squealing from the womb means we get to participate in the best this earth has to offer.
So how were you received by the city in those early days, since you've mentioned permit?
Well, at first, I was fined and I was cited for not giving people a place to wash their hands because I encouraged people to loiter. Because at first, you know, I had to walk around the city with food, and pretty soon there would be 500 people waiting at Occidental Park for my van to pull up. And this went beyond, you know, as the years went on, it went beyond just me. People, because I have a microphone, because I am a performer, I use that ability to reach out to people talking about, you know, justice and social injustice and the need for adequate nourishment. When you nourish somebody with love, you don't only nourish their bodies, you nourish their emotional well-being and their spirit. And, you know, we have to be nourished in so many ways. And, you know, the city of Seattle became friendlier after a while when they figured that I wasn't actually going away. And about 1994, we developed a loose collaboration, and I moved from walking the streets and being down around the parks to serving at the Public Health and Safety Building. And then a nice collaboration was worked out at that point. And it's had its ups and downs. You know, there was the time when the mayor of Seattle closed outdoor meal service, and we served a meal anyway. We sent a letter saying we respectfully disagree with this mandate, and we're going to serve a meal anyway. And we did, and there was a lot of publicity. There was a lot of trucks. There was a lot of radio stations and TV stations. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the night I go to jail. And city council rolled up their sleeves, walked across the street, and served the meal with us. And so they saved the day that day. So at first it was difficult, and then we actually became the poster child for the health department, because we absolutely understand that if you are not serving safe food, you're not doing a service, you're doing a disservice. And if you give 500 people dysentery that don't have homes and don't have toilets, you have done something that is detrimental. And also what the terminology of safe food is, you know, what is safe for a large congregate group of people to receive as food is different than what you might feed your family, and how you feed your family, where it's prepared, you know, that it's prepared in a health inspected kitchen, that it is food that is not past its pool date, no dented cans, and that it has a nutritional content, that it's nutritionally dense, you know, that you're not feeding people all carbohydrates or donuts, or that there is a mixture of, you know, that you're meeting the pyramid. If you're the only place where somebody is receiving nutrition, you have to be able to make sure that that food is actually nourishing. So, you know, we've come a long way from, you know, making... I used to make my lunches, I always put a muffin in there. My muffins were like bullets or hockey pucks, because, you know, I'm not a great baker. So my mom started making the muffins for me, and of course they were great. And pretty soon we were making 4,000 muffins a week. I mean, it was, you know, when I was doing 500 meals a day by myself, it was pretty, you know, it was extensive. There was a lot of prep that went into it. So all my music money went into, you know, doing the food, all my performances, and pretty soon the organization outgrew my ability to earn musically, And that's when it became a 501c3. And, you know, I learned to be a grant writer. I learned to be an administrator. I learned to be an executive director. I received an invitation from Seattle University to attend their executive leadership program. I was one activist in there were 22 people in the class, and there were 21, you know, CEOs and upper management, and there was me. And when we left, there were 22 activists. It was pretty great. So, yeah.
And where do you prepare the meals now?
We have four kitchens. We currently have four kitchens. We have a lovely relationship with the Compass Housing Alliance. In 2004, when they were building their new facility, with a little bit of audacity, I walked into the building and offered a marriage that we would take care of their meals if they gave us the use of their kitchen for all of our other meals. And that marriage has gone on since 2005, and it's been a good one. And then we also take care of Catholic Housing Services, three of their kitchens, and serve their residents. So we do transitional housing, we do direct service at the outdoor meal site on the street. We manage the outdoor meal site for the city of Seattle. And that's open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And we serve, our organization serves about 100 and maybe 20,000 meals at the outdoor meal site. And the other organizations that we schedule into there serve an additional 70,000 meals. And we take care of the community court of Seattle, Nicholsville, the Real Change vendors, seven community kitchens, four youth shelters, and four adult shelters.
And the outdoor center, is that the one that the city focused on the beginning of last year for potentially closing it?
Yes, it is. It's up on 6th and Columbia, and we've managed that for the city since 2006. And it is, you know, not the perfect way to serve a meal underneath the freeway. With, you know, noise and in outside in the elements, even though, you know, we have a covered area. We have the only porta potty for people who are unhoused in Seattle. We have canopies and benches, and we not only serve up excellent food every day, but we serve up a lot of love and dignity. And our hope is, you know, what came out of that potential closure of last year, we were able to convince the city to co-convene a task force with us, and the task force has a very diverse attendance and people that the city suggested for the task force, people that we suggested for the task force, and it's a consensus-run task force. And last year we came out with recommendations to not only not close the outdoor meal site, but indeed to open up other sites around Seattle to fill in food deserts, whether those are outdoor sites or indoor sites that have an outdoor element, and also to move towards a centralized kitchen concept where you have a kitchen, a facility that providers can use where they are able to have a health inspected kitchen, that the food that they are preparing is quality food, and it is run basically like the outdoor meal site, except that it actually has bathrooms and indoor seats, but it has an outside element for the folks who simply cannot come inside. And there are many folks who live in the elements that are not able to walk into a building. And you actually don't want them walking into a building because they're volatile and they are frightened. And so serving those folks in the environment that they are safe in assures that their lives are safe.
So how far away is that central kitchen idea from realization?
Well, the recommendations by this task force has been made to the city that we move towards this. And, of course, it requires more than the city agreeing to it. It requires that there's partners, you know, funding partners. OSL, Operation Sacklunch, we call ourselves OSL now, so people don't think we just walk around with bags of peanut butter sandwiches. And we have a commitment of a little over $500,000 that we are committed to that on a yearly, as a yearly outgo. Our budget, we're a small organization. We do a huge amount of work. We have 20 staff members, most of them formerly homeless folks that we took off the street, and we trained to be holistic chefs. And that they may have already had some restaurant experience, but they didn't have holistic experience working with ingredients that were mainly organic. And if they aren't organic, how to make them safe, you know, with stripping the pesticides and herbicides out of them. And also we do things like we know where our meat is grown if we're using meat, and we do use meat. We just don't use pork. We know that the animals have been sustainably and kindly raised and butchered, and that the vegetables and produce that we use is safer than. And we don't ever buy anything that's been on a boat coming from China for the past 6 months. We buy locally to the United States. So we do a lot. And inside, and I know I'm trying to get back to the recommendations here because I know I went off on a little bit of a tangent. So the recommendations were made last September, and we're hoping that the city government will buy into them and help fund us as we enter the next evolution of our program, the next incarnation. And whether or not the city does buy into it, this still will be the next evolution of OSL, is to develop a centralized kitchen and share our resources. We are a program that believes in sharing abundance and not hoarding our, you know, what we have. We want everybody to share, you know, to be able to participate in our little piece of it is excellent food.
And one of the ways you share is to help get some of the food that is excess food from, let's say, stores out to people that can eat it.
Correct. So we have our Food in Motion program rescues upwards to 500,000 pounds of food a year. So if you think of pounds, you know, it's like 240 tons of food a year that we move through our program. And what we don't use, the food that we rescue that is not attached to Food Lifeline, we share with other organizations for the clients that they are serving. So we're helping other organizations, meal providers. There's all sorts of meal providers out there. There's meal providers that work just with senior adults. There's meal providers that work just with mentally challenged individuals. There are meal providers that work just with children. And there's some food that we don't use, and we only rescue food that we think is absolutely viable. So if somebody was calling us up and wanted to give us a pallet of corn dogs, we wouldn't take it. You know, somebody might take it, but we wouldn't. So we do rescue that food, and our hope is within the next year to get the funding for a mobile pantry where we take this on the road. So we're not only, would be a fully equipped kitchen, and we would not only be taking meals to the food deserts, to the parts of not only King County, but our state that has no food. There are many places in rural Washington where food is very limited, but we would also use the facility as an education mobile, because many people who access food banks are able to access food banks. They still come to a meal program because they don't know how to take the food that they've received in a food bank and turn it into a nutritionally dense and good tasting meal. I mean, everybody wants their food to taste good. So that's what our chefs do, is we teach and we do classes on how to take food on no or low income and turn it into something that, you know, you love.
So it's like taking this concept of food trucks, which have become legal and popular here in Seattle lately, to the next level.
Yes, absolutely.
I love that your term food deserts, because, I mean, it immediately puts an image in my head of these different spots in the city where there's like no food, and you're addressing those. Talk just briefly, in addition to food, on your website you have stories from over the years, and in addition to food, you've also given out blankets, sleeping bags, socks.
Clothes, right? So living in the Northwest, I think it started for me with, excuse me, seems my voice is getting crackly. It started with that people couldn't get their feet dry, so they would get immersion foot. And you know what that is? It's used to get it in Vietnam when they were in the rice paddies all the time. They couldn't get their feet dry is the skin actually peels, the flesh peels off the feet because their feet are always wet. And the folks that I was serving, many of them had immersion foot, terrible wounds on their feet. So I started buying brand new white socks from Costco because you could get them pretty inexpensively there, and did socks with the meals. And then one year, an elderly gentleman, and I usually use the term senior adult, but he was elderly. He was around 86 years old, and he froze to death. It was a cold winter, and he died. And he was one of the regular people that I served. And it was then that I realized that in the wintertime, if you're just sleeping with a blanket, it's not going to happen. So I started purchasing sleeping bags that were temperature safe down to minus 10, and we were handing out bags. And I was the most popular girl on the street when I was doing the bags. But I always caused virtual riots, because people were desperate for a bag. So
you would show up with like 100-150 bags, brand new bags.
150 brand new bags, and I'd be, I had to develop, and the people that I was serving helped me develop protocols on, because they'd say that gentleman already, and they wouldn't call him that gentleman, but that guy would already had a bag, and he's selling that bag down on the street for $10. I was going, social entrepreneurs, this is okay, but not in this particular instance. So I developed a protocol. I took a piece of identification, whether it was a green card, a library, a license. The thing that I have is instant recall on a face. I might not know your name forever and ever, but I know your face, and I would know if I gave that person a bag or not after they gave me a piece of identification. And what I learned to do is at times my line at the beginning of the program, the line was so big and so long that sometimes I barely glanced up. And one day a gentleman grabbed my face and lifted it up. And he said, "You save our lives." And I was thinking, all I'm here, I'm just giving you a lunch. I'm not saving your life. Not changing your life. But it was one of those moments that, when you wonder, why am I doing this? It's so hard. It's taken so much. And that, the memory of that moment is why this organization keeps doing what it's doing. So.
And your site is, again, filled with these stories of you being out in these sizable crowds, hundreds of people pushing, very aggressively pushing to get either a lunch or a blanket or a sleeping bag. And you saying that you're, scared of dealing with all these people because you're a little bit shorter than average. Or as my mom called, petite.
At least you didn't call me vertically challenged. Thanks. Okay.
But in comparison to a raging crowd, that is intimidating for anyone.
Right. I think, I don't think I'm little. I know I'm 4'11", but I think I'm 6'11", and I have a certain amount of audacity, arrogance, and which I work on. I try to be humble. And the people have a heart for those who have a heart for them, and people would ring around me. You know, they would form rings around me and walk me through big areas. And, you know, it was, those early days were very hands-on. I'm understanding. I'm learning about you, and they were learning about me. So it was, and as everything does, everything evolves. We all become older, and if you want something to continue, it can't stay in that area. Everything has to go to its next evolution. And instead of just trying to help with that basic need, food is basic, water is basic. If you don't have the, and breath, if you don't have those three things, shelter, you do need shelter. But if you don't have food, air, and water, then you are no longer a viable organic organism. You know, it has to happen in that order, basically. I think breath comes first. And once you've established that you're helping with basic needs, the next thing is, how do you help somebody to, who's never been told they're worthy, to understand that they are worthy, to find worthiness inside of them? And that's one of the reasons why we serve the kind of food we serve. We don't serve food that is somebody's leftover food. We don't serve crap food. We serve food that you would want to eat at a five-star restaurant, but that is organic, so that it, people aren't trying to fight pesticides and herbicides. And you know, a strawberry has 184 pesticides in it before you eat it, a conventionally grown strawberry. So what you're eating is not a strawberry. You're eating a cocktail of death. So we don't want people who already, who are all already challenged, to have to fight their food in order to survive.
We're talking with Beverly Graham. She is founding executive director of Operation Sack Lunch, and you brought your guitar. We only have a couple minutes left.
I did. I'm
wondering if you would be so inspired to play a little music for us.
Sing you out of here. You ask me why I sing the songs, the ones that make you feel uncomfortable, unhappy, or mad as hell. Well, I share what I am given. Sometimes it makes me scared, but I close my eyes and sing out with my faith. Till we all have faces that someone else can see. Till we all have places in this world. Until we all have voices and true equality, I will sing. And no, I won't be silent. And yes, I will be bold. And my songs might be uncomfortable to hear, but I will sing them, I will scream them, I'll lay down my life, I'll be them. And I pray that when you listen, you will really hear. Till we all have faces that someone else can see. Till we all have places in this world. Until we all have voices and true equality, I will sing.
Beverly Graham, founding executive director of Operation Sack Lunch. How can people find out more about your organization and volunteer?
Yep, go to www.oslserves.org, and you can email us at info@oslserves.org or volunteer@oslserves.org. We see about 4,000 volunteers a year, and we want your your students and your corporations and all you folks to come out and share our work with us and share the love.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time
with us
this morning.
Thanks so much for asking me, even though it was an ungodly hour. Thank you so much, Mike.